Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Feed Your Head. Tonight, Veronica Nowakowski is with us, and we're talking socialism as you listen to the Internationale. Hello, Veronica.
Hi.
It's good to have you. You know, that actually, since I've discovered that song, I feel like I have discovered it. I love it. It's so strange to me because socialism was not always my choice. And I wondered, when did you get interested in it?
Actually, that started when I was 14 years old. Somebody gave me a bad definition of it, and it was enough to get me interested, and I read up more on my own and discovered the real socialism, which was a lot better than what I had heard, which was just pretty much describing Keynesianism rather than socialism.
Mm-hmm. It's, a friend of mine said, well, you know, you all have some good ideas, but maybe you should kick the word socialism. And, you know, because socialism and communism, when I grew up, those were like four-letter words. It was just not even thought that anybody would change from the capitalist system to something like that. And what did your family think when you started reading and maybe talking about this?
My mom was afraid. My dad didn't care one way or the other. He was fine with it, open-minded, whatever I wanted to believe. But my mom, she thought it was the end of the world, that it was going to make me a social leper for the rest of my life and all that fun stuff.
Ah, right. And probably that they would come after you, maybe. I totally understand that, you know, where she's coming from, because they think, well, just like my friend, that's what they think. But now you are on the National Committee of the Socialist Party USA, and you were the campaign committee chair for the Alexander Mendoza campaign this past year. They were running for president and vice president of the Socialist Party USA. Pardon?
Of the United States.
Of the United States. How did you, you know, get into these positions?
I met Stuart 4 years prior when he got the nomination to be the vice presidential candidate back in 2008. And I've spoken with him since. And interviewed him once. He said that when he read what I wrote on internal email message boards, that he basically agreed with whatever I said, even if he didn't start out agreeing with it. Mm. And when I offered my help in helping him there, he just wanted to see, you know, what did he get me to do. Far as being elected to the National Committee, it's just people got to know people within the party, went to the conventions, and 2010, I was nominated and elected.
Okay. So now, how long will you serve on this board?
I don't know how long I'll serve in the end, but each National Committee lasts only 2 years to the next election, next convention.
Oh, okay.
Do what the will of the convention was for, you know, for the 2 years in between.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I didn't know, or I don't know too much about the campaign. It seemed that it sort of faltered because it may not have had national support, because it seemed like the national was a little dodgy, or maybe not, but skimpy, I should say. Have lessons been learned, or am I totally wet in my assumptions?
As far as National Party goes, I don't think there was any real threat to it. You know, there was no hostility from the National Party as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
But there were individuals who were not very happy, and a lot of them have been not happy with anything we've done at any point. They came in not happy with the way it was, and recently most of them left not happy with the way it was.
Yeah.
And it's something that you get through. It's something that happens in a lot of socialist groups because the socialist spectrum is just as wide as the capitalist spectrum.
Right.
From things to the, you know, to the Tea Party, that's the capitalist spectrum. You fit all that to the socialist spectrum as well. Most socialist parties are very narrow. They have a single tendency. They'll be Trotskyist. They'll be Stalinist. They'll be Leninist. They'll be whatever you want to follow. We actually are a multi-tendency party, and we embrace tendencies from, you know, all over, so long as they believe in our statement of principles,
mm-hmm.
which does pretty much keep Stalinists and Maoists and people like that out. But it's a very broad party. It's more of an umbrella party than the rest. And so we get a lot more infighting just because there's that much wider of a spectrum of views. Imagine the Democratic Party, how there's fighting in there, or the Republican Party, and that's just a very narrow spectrum. We're much wider in our views.
Right, so you know that makes sense because you are wider, much more diverse, and while people do agree on maybe the core, they don't necessarily agree on the way that should be carried out.
Correct.
But would you just give us a bit of history of socialism? Because what some people think of socialism really doesn't seem to be.
Okay. Well, socialism is, I mean, I'm very fuzzy on the various different types that there were back in the late 1700s, early 1800s. But it really started big time with Marx. And Karl Marx, that's where most of socialism is basically coming from these days. And it follows the idea that human society goes through various phases based on human production. Marx famously referred to socialism as dictatorship of the proletariat, which is often taken very wrong. They take it as meaning he wanted dictatorship because they use that word. However, who's dictating the entire class of people that happens to include a majority of the people? It was a view that capitalist society is basically a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie or the capitalists, the people who, the 1%, whatever you want to call them, those people at the very top were dictating everything. And quite frankly, they are. You look at the Democrats and Republicans, who do they bail out in the Wall Street mess? They bailed out the Wall Street bankers, the people at the top, while the mainstream helped bailing us out, giving us jobs. It was looking out for people at the top only. So Marx saw socialism as more of a democracy, and he didn't see democracy as in a country that became places like the United States or Great Britain, where you had these elections, you could have socialism through the ballot box. The problem was most places you didn't have that opportunity at all.
Yeah.
So here comes around Lenin, overthrows the Russian Tsar, tries to create socialism from feudalism, which Marx did say was possible for Russia specifically, coming up with a plan that somebody showed me a long time ago, So it goes against the basic tenets of Marxism itself, which says that it's dictated by the means of production. You still have a bunch of serfs out there, can't have socialism. And so after Lenin died, Stalin took over and turned it very, very authoritarian. Whatever advances they had, he basically threw back. And, well, socialism got a bad name as a result.
So, what, since it did get a bad name, when did people start saying, or maybe they never stopped, but, you know, like, this is a good idea and we have to get past that, the negativity? Now, in this country, people will talk about Eugene Debs, who actually won, I believe, a million votes for as presidential campaign while he was in jail. Am I right on that?
It was something like that. I think it may have been 1.4 million, but it was a very significant amount. Mm-hmm. And it was while he was in jail in 1920 for protesting the protesting our involvement in World War One. He was tried as a spy because he opposed World War One.
That I think that's one of the things that a lot of the people I know don't understand. They think like socialism or communism, when you use those words, that you're automatically talking about a war, like we're pro-war, and that's very far from the case.
No, most socialists are looking for peace. There are still people out there who follow Stalin or Mao, and they have pretty much nothing in common with most American socialists.
Right.
Because American socialism is something that has existed long before Soviet Russia. Debs was out there preaching socialism, trying to form the first labor unions back in the 1880s. We formed the Socialist Party of America in the year 1900. Before that, there was the Social Democratic League or something like that. I don't remember the specific name. But, I mean, there were socialist parties out there. They were an American branch of socialism. They were very democratic. They were we were on the front lines fighting for civil rights before it was mainstream, fighting for women's suffrage and women's equality before they were mainstream, fighting for LGBTQI rights long before it was acceptable mainstream to fight for that. When the Socialist Party was very, very happy at first when, Lenin overthrew the Tsar, was going to create a socialist government. You don't know anything about them other than, these are people claiming to be socialists, they're going to create a socialist government. It sounds like a wonderful thing.
Yes.
Debs was very hostile later on towards Lenin's killing of anarchists because they were always worried about counter-revolution, which is something we can learn from. If you're worried about counter-revolution, you're going to end up, destroying the revolution itself from the inside by worrying too much about, some outside force coming in trying to overthrow it. And that's something that I think is very important moving forward. But also Norman Thomas, who succeeded Jeff, he ran as his vice president a few times, or vice presidential candidate a few times. He later ran as presidential candidate pretty much up until the Socialist Party of America dissolved. But he was very hostile towards Stalin and was warning President Truman about, Stalin and not to trust him. Socialism in America, if you're looking at the Socialist Party, it had nothing to do with Soviet Russia. It's not the same brand at all.
Mm-hmm.
And Stalin was very, very specific that when he saw an actual socialist movement, he would try to overthrow it because it was a threat to him the way he saw it.
Okay. And so, but you were saying just a little while ago that people shouldn't concentrate so much on the counter-revolution. So you're saying that inside they need to be strong. And then you don't need to worry so much about the counter-revolution.
Well, it's not just simply a matter of inner strength. It's about a matter of saying, this is what we believe in. We believe in freedom. We believe in democracy. And we, you know, that comes with everything that goes with it. When it comes, we have fascists out there. They should be free to speak their minds, bellies, and whatnot. It comes down to you're only meeting with force if they use force. Mm-hmm. And you're trying, you know, you need to focus on the society we're trying to create instead of focusing on all these fears, because fear always destroys whatever you're trying to build. Yeah. Unless you're trying to build something totalitarian and horrible.
Right. Yeah, and there's so much of that going on. I wanted to ask you about cooperatives, because I find them fascinating. And whether we're talking about Mondragon in Spain or just a small local overtake of a factory, maybe that was going to be sold or something, the workers bought it and are running it. What do you see as the future of cooperatives?
I want to start off by saying that the Socialist Party in general, I think, sees cooperatives as a way of the future, the way to create socialism. It's a very, very basic way of telling workers, hey, you here work together, you own this together, decide together, and so on. Myself, I don't see cooperatives working in the long run. And the reason being that when you have these cooperatives, they work like individual corporations. If this group of workers get together and they own a factory or a group of factories, and you have this group of workers that own it, they're all trying to compete against each other eventually. It's a lot different when they're competing against capitalists, because they can get paid well by comparison, and they can at the same time, you know, offer reasonable prices because you're paying for all that out of profit. I, however, see it devolving into some sort of capitalism if you don't have everybody working together, where you don't have these individual cooperatives, but you have something designed more on the national or worldwide level, depending on how far the socialist government extends. How people want to do that. You could have a socialism that exists on a national level, but most socialists do see, you know, workers of the world unite. We have more in common with each other than with the capitalists in our own countries. We can all work together. We don't need borders and all that. How it will work out, I'm not 100% sure. But the important thing, in my view, I would see cooperatives as working long-term. In the short term, I think they're a great example of how socialism can do better than capitalism, because you can see the workers doing so much better when they are controlling things themselves and when they're, you know, owning all the fruits of their labor, because that's the main idea behind socialism one way or another. It's about, if I produce something, I get that value. I know there had been a study not too horribly long ago where they were measuring out how much of the value of your labor you get. If you're working at a place like McDonald's, you have some sort of blue-collar job, or I don't know what collar job you call McDonald's itself, but when you have that kind of job, you get about one-third of the value of your labor on average.
You get too much. I'm actually surprised, Veronica, that you would get that much.
It's still a lot less than what you'd expect. Somebody who has a white collar job will generally get about 50% of the value of their labor. What they produce is about 50% of, you know, they get paid about 50% of what they produce. The other 50% goes on to the people who own and don't really do anything. And if they do something, generally it's not constructive. And that's you know, that's the nature of capitalism. When you have these people doing so much better because they don't have that middleman, they are self-employed. They may be working together, but together they're self-employed, something that you can't really successfully do by yourself in this day and age because of the amount of capital necessary. Through these cooperatives, they're able to be self-employed.
Right, and have the say over what, even not down to what you make, but you really, people feel empowered and in control. I think that's something that your regular person walking down the street doesn't feel. I mean, they barely feel they can control their life, and they know they can't control their job. So.
Oh, absolutely not. That's why they accept one-third of the belly of their labor, because they are desperate and they don't have any control, and they can't go out like they could 200, 300 years ago and just say, I'm going to go out in the wilderness, I'm going to make my own farm or build my cabin, go hunt. You don't have that ability anymore. Everything's owned. You got to have that money up front, and so you got to either accept these low wages or you die.
Yeah, it's pretty, I mean, it looks pretty bleak there, but like you were talking about doing without borders and this type of thing, that the workers of the world have so much more in common. And I think that, like, intellectually, we may have known this and did for a long time, you know, our similarities. But now with social media the way it is, when we talk to people around the world every day, we see that so much. I mean, that we're all in some type of a struggle against the way our different governments are treating us. So I really think it's possible, this unification. I think we can do it. I'm not sure when or quite how, but I think it can happen.
I think it's going to start. You're going to have local revolutions, which by all means could be through the ballot box where that's made possible. And in a place like the United States, one way or another, we have to win through the ballot box. Because if you don't win through the ballot box, you have no chance of winning in the armed revolution. And it's immoral if you don't have that support.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it ends up in armed revolution, if you have the support behind you, you at least stand a chance. I see all these. That's most likely because you have to keep in mind that not every part of the world is at the same level of development. There are still parts of the world out there who are not ready for socialism. The people deserve something that good, but just the technology isn't there.
Right.
Can they be propped up? That was a lot of the idea behind the Russian Revolution, that they could prop themselves up by a revolution in West Europe. I don't think it's wise to rely upon that in areas like that. It's one of those things that if you get socialist governments elsewhere and they can end up helping them along, that'd be a great thing. But we need to start with the local revolutions, do what you can where you are, and then from there we can start working together to open up borders, to work together as, you know, one humanity instead of all these little competing factions where you're worried about, is my car built in the United States? For example, but the issue isn't so much, is it built in the United States, but what were the workers paid?
Exactly.
It hurts us when you buy from someplace like Mexico or Korea where they pay the workers very little, but let's say you buy a car that was built in Japan. Japanese workers actually get paid better. We're the cheap labor. If you can happen to find that, I say go ahead. Buy the Japanese car. Because that's going to drive wages up here.
Right, and that only makes sense. We know that there's still some countries in Asia where, you know, people are getting by on $10 a month or something, but like you've done the research. So, you know, we have it in our hands to do the research on these different items, things. So I think that one of the things that a lot of us have been talking about, at least on alternative radio and the different media, is for people to start. You're talking about vote at the ballot box. you know, run for office, run for councilman in your little town, run for the school board, do something, like you're saying, from the ground level up, and, you know, get some of the people who feel like you do in office. And that's the way we're going to affect, because the change isn't going to come from the top down. That 1% is quite content living off of the rest of us. And they're going to continue to vote the way they do if we don't vote them out somehow. And we have to have somebody to put in their place. Have you ever thought of running for office? Not just with the Socialist Party, but, like, you know, in your state, in your city, anything like that?
I mean, I thought about it, but I can't go into too many details here. Mm. But because of my job, I can't really run for office while I'm still employed by my current employer. I'm not sure who my current employer is, but I have that issue. Otherwise, yeah. I would run. I ran once, not very heartfully, when I was about 20 years old or so, maybe 22, and just, you know, working by myself, still managed to pull out 82 votes. So, that, I mean, given the size of the district, it wasn't horrible.
Right.
But, you know, I could do a lot better now. I just don't have the ability to. But I do think that people who are willing to, if you can keep from being corrupted, by all means, go out, run. The main thing elections do, when you're out there running, you're spreading ideas. They have to reach out to you. That's why they try to keep a lot of the third parties out of the mainstream debates. If you look at the Great Depression, FDR, he passed a huge swath of legislation known as the New Deal.
Right.
That's because the Great Depression was pushing people to the point where you had fascists on one side and you had socialists on the other, and it looked like the nation was going to go one of those two. To stay in power, capitalists embraced Keynesianism, which is, you know, we're going to go to try to encourage the private market to hire more people, to be more productive through government policies. And that's not socialism, though a lot of people call it socialism. That's Keynesianism. And the entire New Deal essentially came from the platform of the Socialist Party of America at the time. It was watered down a bit, but Social Security, that came from the Socialist Party. It's something that, you know, Americans love. They love the idea when they don't think of it as socialism.
Right.
But fortunately, Stalin sort of spammed the word, but the younger generation is waking up to it. So it's very possible that in the future, you know, 20, 30 years down the road, you could very well have a strong majority for socialism, because the youth will be, you know, at that point, middle-aged.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, you can start, you know, making changes, so long as they don't get, you know, sucked into the humdrum saying, well, I've always lived with the Democrats and Republicans, I can't get past that.
That's hopeful, that 20 or 30 years we may have a majority of socialist people in America, or at least leaning into that. But we do have a lot of programs that, like you mentioned Social Security. At one time, we had fairly free education. I've heard Stuart Alexander talk about when he went to college, it was very, very inexpensive to go to college. And now we know that a college graduate, depending on what they major in, they're apt to owe between $50,000 and $150,000 when they get out.
Now,
go ahead.
Something definitely.
Okay, I just lost you, Veronica.
Okay, I got
okay.
What do you do? Give me just 1 second here. Can you hear me a little bit better now?
Yes.
Okay. When it comes to education and that, that's definitely something we should have free because it gives everybody equal opportunity. However, it's important to also remember that that's not in itself socialism. Socialism is about the collective ownership and control, which means democracy, of our economic production, of the means of production, the factories, the movie theaters, all that stuff. We have to own it collectively. But those are definitely important things that we need to do to try to create the society and try to even things out a little bit as well. Not even necessarily in the outcome that everyone thinks socialism is, everybody gets exactly the same. The idea we're going for is that everybody has an equal chance at succeeding. Everyone's starting out even. I've heard, socialists, claim that we need to have every get paid the same, but they're few and far between. For the most part, it's about getting the fruit of your labor. If your labor is worth X amount of dollars, that's the amount that you get paid. You may get taxed on that because we still have things that we have to pay for. There's people out there who just can't work. People who are just completely disabled, and you want to take care of them. You could have socialism without taking care of them, but I have yet to meet a socialist who didn't want to take care of, people who weren't able to fend for themselves.
Right.
And
right. That's the thing. And as far as like equal opportunity, right, but some people just have different needs. Like families would have different needs than I do. There's a lot of variations in people and what they do need, but I think we're talking about everybody having a chance to really make or have what they do need. And right, I think that the people who are unable to work should be taken care of. It just seems pretty humane not to. Like, we have so many homeless people starving in this country. That just seems inhumane to me, whether we're talking socialism or something else. What kind of programs do you think that we could start to ease into, maybe that we already have or that we haven't, as far as from the ground up, and people would understand that this was socialism, or maybe they wouldn't understand?
Well, the main thing is that when our government goes in and they control anything, it's always something that can't really be handled by the private sector at all. You're looking at the police department. I mean, the private sector has had the police before. They have had the fire department. It's a disastrous effect. You're talking about extremely corrupt system. You're talking about when people's houses are burning down, they don't see that you paid up, so they drive on by.
Mm-hmm.
By all means, that's corrupt. But you're looking at a lot of social programs and things that the government generally runs like that. The first thing we can do is have the government start going in, and next time instead of saying, hey, well, we need green energy, let's go give a bunch of tax incentives for people to develop green energy. That's not that effective. You get some out there. I mean, it's more effective in getting that to happen than doing nothing. But you'd have a lot better bang for your buck if the government went in and did it themselves.
Yeah.
You look at NASA. NASA has made so many of the wonders we have in our everyday lives possible, from computers to our cell phones to ways that they do MRIs now, better imaging. That was all discovered basically by NASA. Somebody took it and used it for profit, and we credit them with coming up with a great discovery. But no, that was, the government working together. And when you go look at even, you know, the innovation, innovation doesn't come from people like Thomas Edison these days. It comes from people who go out and they're working for somebody else, and they get paid a certain amount, and they come up with, you know, these great innovations. They get a fraction of the value of their labor. The government could do the same thing, give them the full value of what they're coming up with, and, you know, you'd see the same innovation coming out of government. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, we have this myth that the government can't create jobs. Well, if you don't let the government create jobs, it can't create jobs. The government can't innovate. Well, if you don't let the government innovate, the government can't innovate. But it's not these little small entrepreneurs coming up with these great ideas. It's these big organizations who hire the, you know, these scientists and these idea men and all that. That, you know, these workers are the ones who are making things happen. It's not the people at the top.
Right, and like you were talking, you don't have the Edisons now because he had what he needed in his own lab. Now to do so much, you have to have labs with millions of dollars, and so you have to work for a company, basically.
Yeah, capitalism basically destroyed itself, and we're coming back to time, because believe it or not, the father of capitalism, Adam Smith, wrote his famous treatise, Wealth of Nations. What people always know about the Wealth of Nations is he talked about the invisible hand of the market. He mentions it twice in the entire book, and it's talking about small producers specifically. What his book is mainly about is how horrible corporations are. The corporation, he felt, destroyed these free mechanisms of the market. You had all this, you know, concentration of power that forced, just inflated prices, inflated profits, and it came at the expense of everybody else. And you look in that same year, 1776, that he wrote it, we had the American Revolution. The American Revolution was all about these taxes that didn't go to the crown. These were taxes that helped enforce corporate monopolies from the East India Company and the like. And you had all these small little capitalists who, you know, these are self-employed people. They may have an apprentice here or there, but they didn't have big enterprises. And they were upset that they were being run out of business by, you know, these giant government-sanctioned monopolies known as corporations. And so corporations in the early days of the American Republic were actually very regulated. If they did not specifically meet the public needs, if they weren't seen as a positive, they were just simply a neutral, they de-chartered them, said, you don't exist anymore, we can do without you, because they were afraid of corporations. But that all slowly changed, and beginning with the 1880s, or the 1870s, you know, big case was won, and corporations started being treated as people legally. Which, with corporations owning other corporations, you have to ask yourself why they aren't put on trial for slavery. But,
good point.
Yet they're treated as people, and that's when it started going downhill. The American... the history of America has been we're fighting against corporations. And yet, if you ask your average high school graduate what, you know, the story is, they'll say it's the exact opposite. That we're, you know, history of America is about, you know, supporting capitalism over socialism and communism and all that. And it's a shame.
Yeah. I think that so much of what people are learning in schools now is so biased, so slanted, so wrong. Excuse me, if not just downright lies. Would you give us a few of the core principles of the Socialist Party, USA?
Okay, if I want to go into core principles, we have our statement of principles online, which anybody can read. You go to our website.
Would you give the website, please?
If you go to www.socialistparty-usa.org, we'll check that. It changed a bit since I first joined, but I just wanted to double check. But you can get it. Yeah, that's, I gave it correct. Socialistparty-usa.org.
Okay.
You can read our statement of principles right there. But if I wanted to summarize the principles of the party, it would basically be one, democracy from the bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
You have this grassroots democracy, a radical democracy, where everything is being controlled by communities, be it at local level or national. Everything comes down to this community control when it comes to the public sectors of life. There's this another big thing is equality. Equality, doesn't matter what your sexual orientation is, your gender identity, which sex you are, which race you are, what religion you are, the sense of absolute, equality, between us all, that we all have equal value and worth, that everybody should be able to go out and experience life in a way that they want, in a way that doesn't, harm others. So, that's a big part of it. Of course, we're opposed to the fake socialism, communisms, the Soviet Union, People's Republic of China, which if anyone has taken a look lately is just basically a very authoritarian capitalism that for some reason our media wants to keep calling communist nonetheless. What kind of communism has corporate sweatshops? But we're opposed to that. We're opposed to capitalism at the same end because it's ultimately about, that everybody has the right to the value of their own labor, that they have the right to they have the right to really be themselves and not be pushed under coercion where people are telling them, hey, you can't grow your hair long or you can't get tattoos because it's not good for business or because, they're authoritarians and just, want to tell you what to do.
Right.
We're opposed to all that. And so it's basically, freedom, democracy, down to the level where we understand that capitalism itself coerces people and takes away their freedom, even if it doesn't do it by brute force. Because it always plays on desperation of people. When people are down, it says, well, I'm going to let this person go if you'll work for a little bit less than he will.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't quite ready to summarize the statement, summarize the principles. But I think that those are probably the main things off the top of my head that we believe in.
Okay, no, that's very good. And then everything pretty much shoots off of those and gets maybe more detailed or something. What would you say to just meeting? I meet people and I just seem to have a way of bringing this conversation around the politics. And, if you mention socialism or capitalism or something, people have such definite ideas and they're not necessarily right. What would you say to somebody who really thinks that socialism is, the plague of the devil?
The plague of the devil. First thing I'd ask them what they think it is,
mm-hmm.
Which if they're saying it's the plague of the devil, they're probably going to say it's Soviet Russia and all that.
Right.
And all you can really do is you can explain that what socialism is. This is what I believe in. This is what you could try to explain a little bit. This is what happened in Soviet Russia. Stalin took power pretty much through everything out of the way that it was intended. But, I mean, the biggest thing is saying, you know, standing to, this is what socialism is. This is what I believe in. This is what I'm going to fight for. If you want to ask me about what I learned about that, that's not, you know, about the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
that's fine. I'll tell you what lessons I learned from it. But don't try to label my beliefs as something that they're not, because this is something that existed long before the Soviet Union in America, this idea of, you know, these socialist beliefs. And, you know, you can also put in a lot of the people who are socialists. You can bring up Martin Luther King Jr., Albert Einstein. You can, you know, all Helen Keller. I believe Susan B. Anthony was also a socialist. These are people who are, you know, a lot of times people that we idealize, but they always leave out the fact that they were socialists. Because if they mention they're socialists, that goes against, you know, the interests of the people who are at the top.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a very good answer, actually, to name some of the people who have been revered through the ages, really. I mean, for years and years, and say, well, did you know that so and so was? That's very good. What do you see happening within the next 4 years, Veronica, before the next presidential election here?
Well,
as far as the Socialist Party, and not just the Socialist Party, I mean, just tell me what you think.
What I think is going to happen with the you know, American electorate is either people are going to wake up and see, you know, they'll listen to things like Barack Obama recently said, then Republican with the same views. People wake up and say, hey, Democratic Party's moving far to the right. The Republican Party is moving far to the right. Voting Democrat is, you know, not doing anything good for us. That's one possibility. And that's if things start really getting bad again, that's what you're going to see. The other thing is people just continue to be in denial. And it's hard to say what it is. I thought people were going to wake up because of Occupy this past time. And there were a lot of people who woke up, but it wasn't nearly the majority. And we got drowned out by the corporate media.
Yeah.
And what we really need is to have some sort of independent media that isn't corporate, that will talk about all these other views. And we can't talk about these views, because no one wants to go to a place that talks only about socialist views unless they're already a socialist. You need something that embraces all the views. It's going to talk about the libertarians. It's going to talk about the fascists, too. It's going to talk about the socialists. It's going to talk about the greens. And really broaden the debate. And bring all these different ideas into play and wake people up. Because people in school, and you'll notice a lot with this, I know in Michigan here we have NEEP, which is pretty much the model for this whole Leave No Child Behind initiative, where everyone's being taught to the test. You have these standardized answers. What it does is it tells people, hey, here's a fact, remember it, but don't learn how to think. And
yeah.
That's what people have been driven down their throats. Don't challenge authority. Don't think. And if you're going to do something rebellious, have it be something like Jimmy Dean. Rebel without a cause.
Mm-hmm.
Because without a cause, you can't really do much damage. You'll get bored and you'll go back into line.
Exactly.
But if you have a cause, then things, you know, that changes the story dramatically. But if people are able to wake up and, you know, sort of be educated, you know, open their minds and say, hey, I'm going to start thinking for myself instead of just, you know, listening. I'm going to learn how to look at the internet, because there's so much bullshit on the internet, and some of that's even on socialist sites. But if you
mm-hmm.
go through it, and if you're able to go look at it, and you're able to say, okay, now this is something reliable. This is something that I can tell they're using reality, and this is something that I can see how they're completely twisting facts, and they're making stuff up. if you're able to do that, you have a lot more power in telling what's going on around you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that Americans need to learn how to do. We have been spoon-fed our information for so long, it's hard to come up and, you know, do that research yourself. But it's all up to whether people are going to learn how to do that. A lot of that's going to be people who are young and in college or in high school and are willing to say, no, I'm going to learn how to think for myself before I get stuck into a pattern where I'm not thinking for myself, I'm just accepting. Because no democracy of any sort can work that way. Socialism can't work with people who aren't thinking, who aren't challenging.
Right.
Because that's how you get people like Stalin.
Well, I know last week I talked with someone who isn't online and rarely reads paper, but watches TV. And I was trying to talk about Occupy, and he did not know what I was talking about.
And I'm not surprised.
I mean, well, I was sort of speechless almost. For me, that's hard to be. I mean, I thought he would have heard something, and I thought he would have not liked it. But for him not to know what I was even talking about, that was beyond me. We do have someone in the chat who said that socialism would be great if it prevented tyrants like the family that started Walmart from monopolizing and enslaving the masses. But socialism's pretty much worked against him. He says he grew up in a poor family and the government took away our property and shut down our farm. Well, that wasn't socialism to begin with. I mean, the government, the socialism in government is not what took away the property. That's happening now. They're taking away their, you know, eminent domain for the pipeline and different things. But that's not, we don't have a socialist government. So we can't blame socialism for that.
A lot of people think that any government involvement in anything is socialism. And that's not socialism, that's just government.
Yeah.
It's something that you have. And although, you know, I like the spirit of the anarchist, what it comes down to is government is what government does. If you have somebody who's holding a gun to your head saying, give me your money, they're governing you. They're the government at that point. If you have your employer saying, hey, you know, cut your hair or you lose your job and you cut your hair, they're governing you. They're the government. So we have this formal government that does things, hopefully, in the interest of the people, and that's only if people actually stay on them and are, you know, inquisitive and they're questioning and they'll challenge abuse of authority instead of going into, you know, this patriotic fervor that you don't challenge the president and you respect the position even if you don't like the man and blah, blah, blah. You have to go out and challenge.
Yeah.
And we have that government there so that it prevents other people from governing us unjustly. That's, you know, that's the purpose of government, and we really need to go out there and, you know, we have to have some sort of government, and sometimes government's going to be corrupt, and that means get rid of the people who are in there because they're not doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have to make sure that they're not just going based off of fervor. You'll see sometimes, you know, government is so geared towards accomplishing one goal to solve one injustice that they create, that creates others. So everything has to be, you know, you have to think things through. You have to hear from all voices, even if it's somebody you hate. Because Trent Lott might have a good point every now and then that might make something a little bit better if you take into account.
Yeah. That this I really don't think that when many of our elected officials go into office, I don't think that they are so determined to be such bad representatives. But it seems like people are easy to be corrupted now, and more into the, well, I'll get what I can. And we need to elect people that just don't have that kind of a mindset somehow. Ah, and we just lost Veronica. Well, I want to thank her for all she had to say. There was a lot of information that she gave us. So, and she's back. She's back to wind things up. Yeah, you just dropped. It's like, wow.
Yeah, randomly dropped. who knows? That's going to be tapping my phone right now.
Okay.
I'd be surprised. Some calls during the campaign, you heard echoes or it got scrambled like I've been hearing. So it's possible.
Yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't really matter one way or another.
Yeah, we don't know a lot of those things, exactly going on.
But anyways, the point we were on was what again?
Oh,
elected officials. And basically the ones that win are the ones that have money because mm-hmm. they put the ads out. The media goes, covers those ones because they're the ones that are funded by corporations.
Right.
And basically, if you see somebody who's being funded by a corporation, it should be a red signal that they're not looking out for you.
Yes.
And you see that Democrat on TV, they're not looking out for you because they wouldn't be on TV if they were looking out for you.
Exactly. They wouldn't, because they wouldn't have the money to be. This country spent, I read, $6 billion on the election this year. And our socialist candidate spent very, very, very little. There was no corporate money.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was only $5,000. I didn't keep track myself. But
if it was that much. Yeah. Yeah.
We didn't have the funds. We were hoping that people would pour in, you know, $5, $10 here. That's where Obama got a lot of money back in 2008. He got a lot more from Goldman Sachs. They got, you know, he was able to get people to pour out that little bit.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we didn't get many people handing out donations. And because of that, we couldn't get the message out as well. And we did get,
It's hard though because money does. A lot of people say. In fact, somebody told me the other day, we really need to limit the campaign donations and contributions, and it would be nice if we just didn't let corporations fund our candidates. But I do want to say to our real story in chat that you've got to have something right other than money in mind for any kind of politician, and whether they're capitalist or not. But capitalist, money is, well, it's at the top of the list. So this is why we're really needing to get away from that. But
money is power, and they showed it by showing how they can buy elections.
Exactly.
They'll pay for both Democrats and Republicans to run. That way you could choose between two approved candidates and everyone else is ignored.
And that's the way it's been, and we're going to have to change that. The Socialist Party, you can find out more information about the platform and things at www.socialistparty-usa.org. And Veronica, you've got about 45 seconds to wind up. Just words of wisdom. I thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much, too. And just one phrase I want to put out there, economic democracy. That's what I like referring to socialism in general, if I'm talking to people who don't know much about it.
Okay, economic democracy. That's the catchphrase. Okay. So thank you, my friend, and have a wonderful weekend. Thanks for all your information. Okay. Good night.
Bye.
Bye-bye.